This episode is brought to you by Fat Expats. It's the new expat magazine that's coming your way next month. If you'd like to find out more about it, head over to twofatexpats.com. You'll see a pop-up and you can sign up and we'll shoot you some information. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Kirsty Rice. And congratulations to you wearing your minor premiership cap on the pod.
Oh, my gosh. So good, so good, so good. For those that don't know, my football team came out on top last night. It was a happy, happy night. I'm sure you saw, Nikki, I posted my glass of champagne that I poured at 9:20 at the end of the game on a Monday night, as you do.
No, of course. It's perfect. What else are you going to do on a Monday night except have a glass of champagne? And is that the first time that they have won the minor premiership?
No, we also won the minor premiership in 2004, which was the year we also won the premiership. But we've won it in 2001, 2002, and 2003 as well.
Right. So it's been a little while between drinks on a Monday night.
Oh, yes. Yes. And the last grand final, I was in Calgary and we drove into town with some neighbours to go and watch it in a bar because, of course, it wasn't on any television screen and there was no live streaming of things back then. When I think of these things, Nikki, expat life seems so old school back in the day, doesn't it?
When actually...
There's no way I would go out now. Do you know what it would all be? I would have paid for a package, you know, that on watchafl.com or whatever and watched it at home and maybe had friends over at home. But anyway, we drove into town. It was cold because it was September in Calgary, because quite often it snows by the beginning of October, end of September. And we went to a bar called Bottle Screw Bill's, and of course it was full of other Australians that were all there doing the same thing we were, watching the AFL Grand Final. And our neighbours, I remember the first ball bounced and everyone, you know, ran at each other as they do and started playing, and my next door neighbour said, "Has anyone ever died playing this game?"
Well, and they can say that, and they've got ice hockey, let's be honest.
Yes, true. But see, they wear all that padding. They've got all that padding and they're all protected. And have you ever seen a fight at the they don't call it ice hockey. They only call it hockey in Canada. They don't.
Yes, no, I know. Yes, I have, because, yes, of course, I've done my Saskatoon winter. That's my badge of Canadian honour.
Yes. And then if they do have an argument, they're going to have a fight. It's like something out of Waterworld where, you know, the whole stadium starts to cheer and then it takes them a good 5 minutes to get all their gear off. You know, they've got to rip their helmet off and then rip off their gloves and, you know, square up. And it's like, oh, come on. Okay. All right, let's move on to four fat questions, Nikki. I have noticed in our Two Fat Expats Facebook group there's been a little bit of questioning about jobs, because this is usually about the time where people move for schooling or jobs or whatever. But obviously COVID's put a bit of a different spin on the questions. But I wondered about that. I wondered if you had to negotiate a new job at the moment, what would be important to you, like with your 20 years of expat experience, now with COVID in mind and you were negotiating a new job, what would be different?
Well, I'm not 100% sure, really, because I think at the moment the point is that you're really grateful to have a job and to be getting a job. So I think that possibly employers are in a bit of the driver's seat. You know, when they're selling in real estate, they say it's a buyer's market or a seller's market. I think it's probably a buyer's market at the moment, the buyer being the employer. Yeah. So there's a lot of things you might want to negotiate and you would certainly have on your list. And I think that it's probably a list that you'll have from now on, because now this has happened. Now there's been this massive disruption in our lives, in our expat lives and in everyone's lives. People once again see the potential of what could happen. And as much as we talk about, you know, returning to normal or returning to the way things were, and it could very well happen and it could be out of our minds, we are of the working generation that will remember that this happening and how it happened and not necessarily why it happened, but what happened and what the impact on us was. So we will be the cautious negotiating more group of people, whereas coming up from still in high school now, haven't had a job yet, in 10 years they'll be the whole, or, you know, in 5 to 6 years they'll be the people who have, didn't impact them, so that they'll have another set of probably guidelines and information they want. Mm-hmm. So, Kirsty, what would be on your list?
I'm thinking that because I've always been very happy with the idea that we were given an allowance to get home. Do you know? So how it worked in our house was, instead of the company, you know, paying for you to get home, they gave you the equivalent of what was, you know, a business class fare, which of course we then spread out over lots of economy fares that we, you know, bought on our own, because that sort of meant that as a family we could fly home once a year using economy, and we could maybe go somewhere using economy, and that sort of worked out. But, you know, now with everything that's happened and we're watching people have to sort of flee from places because either their work permits expired or they've lost their job or different things have happened, I'm actually wondering whether you're better off, if you can, because like you said, it's not a buyer's market at the moment. But I'm wondering if you could negotiate that the company covers your airfare home, because I think if you work, and that is also if you work for a big corporation. I mean, if you don't, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, because I was thinking like a business class fare, that's nice. Like we used to have a fare every 2 years, which was economy, which we would have to pay in advance and then claim back. But we don't even have that anymore because we've gone to a localized contract. So, yeah, I mean, for people that do have that.
Yeah, and even if it's not, Nikki, talking about a home leave allowance, but it's talking about an end of employment
arrangement. End of employment, I think, is fair, yeah.
Yes, and maybe thinking about, okay, well, if we are going to go on this, take this contract somewhere else for 3 years and we're not going to go home, well, then maybe I want to make sure that I'm probably looking at what sort of COVID plans are in place at the schools that I'm looking at. I'm looking at if I needed to be medevaced, what would happen there. When I'm looking for a house, I'm probably now looking at housing far more conscious of how would that work for homeschooling, or how would that house look for me working from home. You know, all things that I never, ever would have thought about before, but they might be things you've got to really think about now.
No, 100%. It's just a different set. So you've always had a set of information that you've had to process and think about depending on the location. And now that information is different. So you've always thought about, what if I lost my job? What if I lost my job during non-COVID is so different to what if I lost my job during COVID. You know, that's two sets of things.
Yes.
You know, and what if this happened? What if that happened? You have to now all put over, not necessarily COVID, but the next pandemic, because, you know. but you know, like if this happened again in 2 or 3 years, you know, what would I need? And look, I think big corporations are going to be thinking about that. Smaller companies and, you know, the international school environment, the international teacher environment, all those things, I think they're going to change over time, but it'll be interesting to see how fast that happens and what those changes are.
Yeah. I know someone who has resigned recently in Doha and they will be returning to Sydney to start a new role. They cannot get out of Doha until at the very earliest January. So
wow.
Yes. So their situation, and that is get out of Doha and get into Sydney. So they're now looking at, okay,
where? Oh, Sydney. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So where would I be flying into? How else could I do this? All right, would I fly to Adelaide and do 2 weeks quarantine there? And then how would I get, you know, from Adelaide to Sydney, et cetera? Like, these are all things that we were not thinking about back in March. So I think that is it, because then, like you said, it just adds a whole extra layer, because then it's like, okay, well, once I resign from my job in Doha, how am I covered for medical until I can fly out? What happens if I have a medical emergency and I no longer have my Qatari healthcare card that was provided by my Qatari
employer?
All these things that usually it's a little bit of a nightmare while you do that little crossover of closing bank accounts and selling cars and doing whatever. But now we have this added thing. So I think that's something to think about.
100%. Okay, Kirstie, related, kind of. So how do you research a new expat location? And if you're doing it, do you usually have a choice? And how has it changed for you over the years? A choice of, like, when I say that, I mean a choice of location.
Mm.
So, for example, we never have. We've usually been presented with a job option. Is this job appealing to you? Would you be interested in going there? The end. But I know a lot of people.
What happens if the answer is no?
Well, if the answer is no, which it was several times when we lived in Hong Kong and we both had really good jobs, and I would say, no thanks. Then it was fine, because the company that my husband was working for wasn't super structured. It was just that this opportunity's come up. Would you like to take it? No, I wouldn't. That's okay. He didn't lose his current job, kind of thing. But some people are on contracts that have an end date, and the company expects that they will take another job because they have a highly mobile global workforce. That sounds like something of the past now, but, you know, it could still be of the future. You know, international schools have a system where they have a 3 and 4 year contracts, and very rarely, particularly because people do it for the lifestyle, they do it because they want to live in different locations. So, you know, they're often, but they do a lot of self research or go to the fairs or whatever. And then there are other people like diplomatic postings. So it's like a uni course. You put your top 5 posts and then you sort of go through the process that way. So that's what I meant. Why do you have a choice? How does it work?
Yeah. Okay. So for the first 11 years of my expat life, we really didn't have a choice. We were conned into, you know, they placated us pretending we had a choice, but we didn't really have a choice. So first role was Jakarta, and I did zero investigation. And I reckon maybe I might have met some people in Perth where we were living at the time and said things like, hey, have you ever been to Jakarta?
They said, no, but we've been to Bali.
Yeah, 17 times. But I think that I probably really lived by the Kirstie Rice school of life, which was, you know, it'll all work out, because that's kind of very much how my life has rolled. It'll work out. It'll all fall together. So, no, going to Jakarta, I didn't do a lot, but I was also very lucky we moved there with a large corporation, and so they had, you know, all those lovely little things in place where you had welcoming committees, and, you know, and those days I think are really gone too, because it was so, people really had to go out of their way to welcome you and invite you and offer you things to do, because there wasn't, you know, the same things that we have now. So, for example, when we got to the hotel room, I think I had, you know, 3 phone calls within the first few days of people saying, hi, welcome, you know, I heard that you were coming, blah, blah, blah. And then I probably went about my business of, like, joining the Australian New Zealand Association, or I joined the museum club because I was really interested in the museum. You know, I went on, if there was any sort of tour or anything that was going, I just went on it, did it. I was also 5 months pregnant, so I joined every, you know, antenatal and new mother group that happened, and that was sort of how it went. And I think, because I did see that you posted this in the group last night, you were asking people what they did. And they were all, I haven't read them all because you posted just before I went to bed, but in the early days I saw that a few people had said sort of similar things. You know, usually I've got a friend of a friend, or I ask, you know, has anyone ever lived in Azerbaijan, or has anyone ever, you know, lived in Calgary or whatever, and you find it through that expat network. But I think what is so vastly different now is because I've also moved to very small locations where it's been a very tight-knit community, but there was no Facebook.
Yeah, there wasn't an expats in Libya Facebook group to join.
No, there was none of that.
Or English-speaking mothers in Libya. Or...
Yes, and there were no, and even when you think to the early days of Facebook, there were no Facebook groups. There were Facebook pages.
Yes.
But there wasn't Facebook groups. And now there's Facebook groups. It's so easy. But I can remember when I was in Houston and I was moving to Qatar, I think I Googled, oh no, even then I knew someone who knew someone, do you know? And it was a woman I knew in Houston said, I've got a friend that started a children's nursery there, and who ended up being one of my best mates. But I remember someone said, oh, you should contact the Doha mums or whatever. And so I sent them an email. How archaic is that? And they emailed back and told me what to do and how to do it. So, I think mine was very much friends of friends, but now I would totally just do Facebook groups.
I know. And something that I saw that people said, oh, I used to look for blogs, but that doesn't work so much anymore.
Oh, wow.
Which I thought really interesting, because that means that people aren't blogging as much. So I guess people now have moved to the Quibi version of blogging, which is Instagram. And they do the Instagram stories or the Instagram posts, and they do like a big caption so that they do the photo of my life, and here's what. But you wouldn't really, that they're more difficult to actually find.
Yes.
Whereas when the people did blogs, you could just Google, you know, four kids, 20 suitcases in a Beagle. No, that didn't, you didn't know to start there. But if you Googled I mean, about how many people have said that they found your blog when they were Googling about expat life, and how many people joined, you know, your cult follow? No, sorry, your followers, and you know, would wait with bated breath for every new post and really relate to it, et cetera, et cetera. That just, I don't think that kind of blogging exists anymore.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. In I hadn't even thought about that, Nikki, but you're right in that I would, you know, not constantly, because I think the people that were reading the blog were, you know, expat women from wherever, but you've made me remember now that there would always be, you know, once a week someone saying, oh, hi, you know, I'm moving to Qatar and I found your blog. And then they would ask me some long and involved question about where their children should go to school or what they should do. And I'd think, oh, God, I'm not the right person for this. But I'll, you know, point them in the right direction so that they can find people. But, yes, you're absolutely right. And that was a way that people found information.
Yeah. And the other thing that a lot of people said was, you know, well, I've been an expat for 20 years, so I always know someone who's lived there or someone who's going to live there or someone, a friend of a friend. And one thing I did notice was when we were moving to a particular country, I would ask people about it, and it really depended who you asked as to the response you got. So I said, I sort of pushed the group and I said, have you ever been given a wrong steer from a friend or a friend of a friend? You know, like given information that wouldn't necessarily be the way that you would relate to that country or didn't end up being your lived experience. You know, obviously we moved to a country, it was a bit controversial in terms of would you move there or not? And so people had really strong opinions. And if I only listened to one set of people, you know, we might have said, oh, no, we're not going to go there.
Yeah.
So I think that that's also having a friend of a friend or a friend of yours give you the information can sort of put you in one mindset that isn't necessarily the mindset you need to be in.
Yes.
Or, you know, particularly if you don't have a choice.
Do you know what I think? If you have a friend of a friend, your friend might say, oh, hey, you know, Judy's a bit of a misery, or Judy's, you know, or Judy can be a negative Nelly. So, you know, don't maybe take it all to heart. Or Susie's great because she's good fun and she'll show you wherever, you know, I'll put you onto her. Whereas when you go into that Facebook group and you ask, you don't really know what you're going to get or who you're going to talk to. And, you know, I think about it now, you know, Nikki, all those places I moved to in the early sort of 2000s or for the 2000s to 2010, you know, people did the kindest things where they would drive to your house with, you know, things for you and drive you places and do anything and help you out and whatever. And I wonder now that it's a little bit easier with Facebook groups, you know, I'm sure people still do it, but is it harder to make that one-on-one connection?
That's a really good point, and I think it might be. You know, and I think this is why people are, you know, because they're in these sort of more difficult or less English speaking or, you know, these kind of locations, people would make a really big effort because they'd think, geez, I've been there. I've been you standing in the supermarket not being able to read the ingredients in something, or, you know, I've been there. Yeah. I'll take you to a supermarket. Here's the three best supermarkets. Here's where you can find the kind of food that you're used to until you get used to local food, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so there's all these different things that people would do for you that they now people can almost do for themselves because you can read about it in a Facebook group or ask a question in a Facebook group and say, you know, where would I get this? And 10 people can tell you. But it's really not the same as, I guess it's another part of this technology gives us access to so much more information and people, but still
stops us from
human connection.
I remember in Libya getting a cake mix from the store. It was all written in French and Arabic, and driving with the cake box to a colleague of Greg's who is French to his wife's house to say, this says to something, but I can't. I don't know what it is because no internet.
Yeah,
right.
Now Google Translate, right? And so
I would have just gone to Google Translate. But I remember the hilarity of her saying to me, "It's two eggs." I didn't know that a oof was an egg.
Well, now you do because that was before Canada.
Now I do.
You see, that was before Canada.
Yes.
That's now your French immersion children, any one of them could have read that.
Yes, with a definite eye roll involved. But yeah, like that is gone now because we have, you know, this technology that supposedly helps us out so much, but it does. It stops those candid moments of having to feel like I'm so lost or whatever. Well, you know, let me just Google that.
Yeah, I mean, even 10 years ago in South Africa, a Scottish friend said to me, this was before I lived in Germany, but why had my schoolgirl German? You know, I've got a friend that's moved back to Germany and I'd like to buy a toy for her child from this German website, but I can't do it. Can you help me? I said, sure. No. But I thought, you know, one, I like this girl. She could be my friend. And two, it's what you do, right? There were no Germans left. So let's just get the girl with the high school German and see if she can help. Anyway, we ordered the toy. Goodness knows if they ever got it. But no, they did. But, you know, you just do things like that. Like it's not quite up to two eggs. Cake without eggs is a whole different situation.
I don't know why I couldn't work out. And here's the thing, right, because I'm sitting here thinking, well, why couldn't I work out that was egg? Surely that would have been quite simple to work that out. But maybe it was all a bit of a rouge too, just to go over and have a face-to-face conversation with someone, to have a friend, you know, to be able to have
because
that moment.
Because when you move. Human connection is what you crave. You crave something. You know, it's like walking outside, speaking in another, or listening to another language, or trying to do something in another language all day is exhausting. Dealing with your own family, yeah, if you're lucky enough to have them, children in the house, you know, exhausting. You know, just wanting to speak to another adult who has no skin in the game, but would, you know, it's just, it's something that, you know, you really almost need, but you don't have to do it. And that can become really alienating, I think, because you can come home and just get on the computer and go, oh, well, if I did this all differently tomorrow, what would I do? And just go down this rabbit hole and then not spend the time actually connecting with people. So, yeah, big changes in the world. Yeah. Anyway, but it has, I think the answer is, has changed a lot how people do research a new location and what they go about and what they use to make their decisions.
Do you know what we should do, Nikki, now that we've posed the question and we've identified that while it's easier, it's perhaps harder? I think the next thing is to think of next week, we'll come back and give people a couple of ideas of how to find your people and your connections and not get lost in all of that if you are moving.
Yeah. So we'll
come back with a couple of tips next week. Nikki, I want to ask you, hypothetically, you've got an 8-day-old baby. Think about it. Tell me, could you and your partner and your 8-day-old baby, could you handle 14 days quarantine in a hotel room?
Well, you know, now I think it sounds pretty good.
Yep.
Because I know what it's like to have an 8-day-old baby and not having to worry about making meals or doing all the washing or making my house was neat and tidy or doing all those things. Uh-huh. That sounds great. And you've just asked me hypothetically. So, yeah, you know, I'm a 50-year-old woman. I don't want an 8-day-old baby. But so, but when I was young and having my first, well, 32 and having my first baby, could I go? No, absolutely not. I would freak me out. I mean, really? What if something happened? And what if I think it's ideal, really. But one, how are you getting an 8-day-old baby into quarantine? I don't understand that. How have you flown them internationally somewhere? How does all that work? Where did this question come from, Kirsty Rice?
I'll tell you where this question came from, because, and full disclosure, I think each of my children, my first child I flew with, she was 11 days old, we flew back to Jakarta. My second child was 11 days old and we moved to Libya. And when I think about it, what we moved to really was very similar to what quarantine was like, because we moved to we moved to a place where workers transited in and out. They called it a guest house, but please don't envisage anything pretty when you hear the word guest house, because it was nothing pretty about it. And we were stuck in a room with just four beds. Like, it had a double bed, and no, three beds, double bed, two single beds either side, and a bathroom. And really the guy that was there thought that we should have considered ourselves so lucky because we had our own bathroom, whereas everybody else had to share. But I lived like that with no car, no friends or no anything, but I had this 11-day-old baby and just what we'd carried with air freight. Where the question comes from is, this week in the world of AFL football, a player has had a baby and then was going to return to the hub to keep playing football. He's a very good footballer. His wife has had a baby. And they have decided, no, they won't come back because it's too hard to have an 8-day-old baby in quarantine for 14 days in the hotel. And I was thinking, have I just forgotten? Like, have I become one of those women that's forgotten what it's like to have a new baby? And so I'm being unreasonable. But I was also thinking, you know, so many expat women could do that on their heads. Do you know, they wouldn't think twice about getting on a plane and going to a hotel room. And as long as, you know, you could sterilize things and you had a supply of, you know, clean clothes and diapers slash nappies and, you know, whatever you needed, you would get through that 14 days, I'm sure, pretty well. If someone was coming in and changing your sheets, or, you know, you had clean sheets delivered to your door or whatever, I think I could very well do that, knowing that it was just 14 days. Listen to me, I'm saying just. But knowing that it was 14 days and I could then be out and about. But also thinking about, well, that's my partner's job. That is what they get paid to do. And this is all part of the process, right? But what has amazed me, and happily, because I think we've come a long way, is very much the football fraternity is very much on their side, saying, yes, it is an unreasonable request. And I have not heard one male or female commentator in the football world say, oh, come on, you know, they could do 14 days, you know, if that's what their job is and that's what it gets paid to do and whatever. Everybody has said, no, 14 days of quarantine with an 8-day-old baby is too hard. So,
oh, come on, drink a cup of concrete. Like, I think, no, look, I think now with everything that's expected of a brand new parent, and it's not that it's expected that they place their own expectations because of the internet and because of this whole thing, you want the support, an extended support situation. I would think about what I was thinking about when you were saying that is 14 days. So could I go outside? Could I ever get away from the sound of my baby crying?
Mm.
No, you can't do that. And that is highly stressful when you're a new parent.
Mm.
That is honestly one of the best things, yes, is to just walk outside, to walk away from your crying baby who's being comforted by another adult, another parent, but just being able to walk away, yes, and just have that break in those first 14 days. I would think there would be some mental health related concerns. Mm. But having said that, no, everything else, I think, and you know, you're a trooper. I mean, I think I traveled with a 3-week-old baby to Australia, and I traveled with my husband, a toddler, and our nanny.
Are you calling your husband a toddler?
No. There was a toddler and my husband and a baby and me. I would never call him a toddler on air. So I think, you know, like, it is possible. And you don't want to take a nanny with you, like, or a night nurse or something to a quarantine room, because you'll have to be there together. No one could get out. So any of the help that they would get isn't available to them, except from a nurse who would probably come, you know, they would probably be in a health hotel, and, you know, they could arrange all sorts of different bits and bobs. But I can see how it would seem insurmountable to me in that situation. I can see it, and I'm interested. I hadn't seen that in the Australian media, but as we know, I don't follow the AFL media. But I do follow the AFL tipping competition of Two Fat Expats, Kirsty.
Oh, and I hate to think. I've been so bad at putting my football tips in.
I just want to say that I think I came third, and I don't think you did.
Well done. I'm going to have a look now. I'm going to have a look now, because we should be giving credit to who came first.
Okay, so what we have to say about the tipping competition is it's not perfect this year, because we did have some people start the week behind. So at the end of the day, I'll have to go back and see, and we'll have to average out one of the weeks. But Helena has no idea. Won last year, came in equal first this year.
Oh, wow.
I mean, she's kidding us all. But Claire W is the winner on margins and bits and bobs this year. So well done, Claire W. But third place, Nikki Moff. Way to go, me.
Well done, Nikki Moff. And I can see Donna Coghill came fourth. That's very good. Georgie W, Tiger Gigi, she's come fifth. And then Dot has come sixth. Fiona has come seventh. And then Emma Jones, Coco Loves the Crows.
Oh, yes, it couldn't be Coco Loves the Crows, Kirsty. Yeah, I know that you don't love them, so that's something for next year, something to aspire to.
I found myself barracking for the Crows towards the end of the season, because I did start to feel quite
bad that they hadn't won any games.
Yeah. I did. But they did. They came home on a rampage. So they're going to be
quite
great.
Well. They yeah. did.
All right.
100%.
Last question.
Last question, Kirsty. So changing travel in a post-pandemic world, there's sort of a theme this week. We hope, obviously, we get there. So my question to you is, will people book their summer holidays in Europe from another continent, or will they stay closer to home and explore their own country / continent? Now, this came up because I was reading a Wall Street Journal article about the future of travel, and it caught my eye because it, you know, it's one of those 10 things about the future of travel. And the first point was, we'll rethink Europe. Expect a cooling of the, and this is written from American perspective, of course, expect a cooling of the romance with Europe's capitals and a new affection for less crowded cities with strong cultural offerings. And here's the quote. I'd keep an eye on Lyon and Hamburg, says UK-based travel writer Annie Fitzsimmons, who also predicts a rediscovery of less populated European islands, among them Germany's 24-mile long island of Sylt, Teutonic Nantucket, which is true. So that's saying that Europe will exist, but people will go to less crowded places, which I cannot imagine there are less crowded places in Europe in summer. But that's what the travel writer says. But what do you think about the future of
travel? Do you know what? Travel? I think this is so interesting to where we're at, I guess, today in
yep.
What are we, September 22nd, in that in Australia you're not travelling anywhere. You're not even entertaining the idea of going overseas. Do you know, it's not happening. And whereas if you're in Europe, you are, you know, and I see it. And I guess what I'm saying is interesting is when this all first started, you know, Nikki, you and I discussed a lot about we're all in this together. It's the first time that we're as a population, we're all dealing with exactly the same problem at exactly the same time. But of course, what has changed now is we're all dealing with it differently. And because we've all sat back and our governments have made decisions and done things. And so, you know, a regular conversation that you'll hear in Australia all the time is something you and I think discussed in the last couple of weeks, where Australians will say, hey, I don't get it. You know, my friend in the UK is going to Croatia this week. Like, how? Like, how is that?
I don't get that either.
How is that happening? Or, you know, my friends have gone to France this week. Like, how? And so when I think about articles of, you know, people saying, oh, you know, we're all going to travel to maybe Lyon or Hamburg or whatever, I just think this is where it's going to show people that are in such a different headspace. And also, is that article, like all COVID articles seem to be, completely defunct within 2 weeks of its posting? Of that, you know, a second wave comes and, you know, everything shuts down again or whatever. So, yeah, what do I think about people with travel? Well, if I'm in Australia, I'm saying, no, we'll try, you know, Australians are going to travel within Australia. I know I have a girlfriend who's a travel agent, and only recently she had to use up some of her miles that she had, and her options were Kangaroo Island or Kangaroo Island, which is, you know, about 75 minutes down the road from where I am now, but she got to fly there to use her points. And they had a lovely time. But, yeah, I don't know anyone that is thinking of travelling outside Australia who is currently in Australia, only if they are, like my husband, going back to work at some point. Now, if we were in Doha, I'd say we'd have a very different perspective.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I have to giggle at some of the things in this article. So it's anyway, it's a bit weird. But so it's saying, where will we be traveling in years to come? So it's not looking at the immediate future. So it talks about rethinking Europe. Alaska will beckon. So the pandemic's searing impact will add a FOMO-like emergency to personal bucket lists. And so, you know, Alaska's been big for the last few years in Australia, you know, people flying up to Alaska and doing things, as will esoteric food. So more people will seek out the Faroe Islands. for cooking things. And then it says, like, it just tries to come up with these weird ideas. We'll do a quick eye check-in. So, like, your eyes will be your check-in things. We'll pay for our hygiene. So it says that germophobic flyers might have the option to pay extra for hygiene class, which it points out we'll still be using the same air filtering systems as economy, but whatever. Well, this I do not understand, and I cannot understand, and I don't know how it got in here. It says we'll cruise the Arctic as pleasure ships steam past the pandemic and implement new health protocols. Expect to see new destinations. The cruise industry specialist optimistically sees massive growth in trips through Canada's Northwest Passage. Like, no.
So, Nikki, what do you think? What do you think your future travel?
I'm not sure.
Like,
hover bags. I'll be having a hover bag, which is also suggested. Hover bags will take off, just follow you around, because it'll be attached to your watch and you'll just walk around and it'll follow you. So, look, I don't really know. I think that there'll be a lot more domestic stuff. Like, in Europe, everyone went domestically this year. I'm still surprised. Like, I'm seeing families in Queensland pack up cars and drive off for camping trips, and I still think that's weird when I think about Australia being in it. Well, I just think that about Australia being in a different, like you're saying, in a different mindset. So, you know, like, here we're packing up the car and we're heading off for 2 weeks. But at the same, like, and they can't go interstate. But at the same time, I've seen them, all those same people, having prom or formal, year 12 formal picks, whereas there's still another state that's locked down. I still can't get my head around Australia and the different areas, the different ways. Like, here we've been pretty consistent. We've worn masks in inside and on public transport for a long time, and that hasn't changed really, apart from when we were physically, you know, asked to stay inside most of the day. So I kind of feel like we've been on a trajectory and the numbers have sort of ebbing and flowing around us. So, but in terms of travel, look, I mean, we talk about when we can next go to Australia, and we were there at Christmas, which feels like forever ago. Like, it doesn't feel like it was just 9 months ago. It really feels like a lot longer. And my mother-in-law, we were talking the other day, and via message, and she said, you know, I always want to see you, but it feels more urgent now, that, you know, to see you guys. And it's just a different feeling because you can't get there. And so I think, I mean, we talked about, you know, when this first happened, my husband said, well, should we go to Australia for Christmas? I said, buddy, I think you're dreaming, just in terms of being able to go. But now it feels really horrible that we can't, not that we would have normally. So our normal every 2 years would have been next Christmas. And, you know, we hopefully will be able to do that. But I think that we'll do that with a totally different mindset and view and take on the whole thing, because it will just be a totally different It's not the access we always have to getting on a plane. I think the places that you go, you will view with more awe and wonder, because there was a time that you know that you couldn't get there. Whether it's just a camping holiday and you're by a fire and a lake, or the ocean, or I don't think you have to be seeing great, amazing world structures or museums to just think, wow, you know, 6 months ago I couldn't have come here and now I can, whatever it is, whatever the place. Yeah. And that's what I really think. I think that, you know, there'll be a lot more people traveling by car in Europe, which is, of course, you know, people don't want, it's not encouraged. Train travel is encouraged, but, you know, all that kind of stuff. But you still, I even think when you do that, you're still going into either hotels or Airbnbs, and you don't know who was there before you. Like, you think you're wiping down every surface, but you're going to miss one, you know, and it doesn't mean you're going to catch anything. But I think that gives you, you know, obviously if you do the statistics and the probability, not the same amount of risk as going on a crowded plane. But I just think that we will be more grateful for the travel that we can do.
For that things, I told you I updated my LinkedIn profile. Then I was going to go and get a professional pick. I'm struggling to find the person to do the professional pick. Like, how do you find someone that's not that's not like a glamour photographer. How do you find a good photographer? Do you know, I don't want to do the whole soft focus, whatever. How do you find the person?
Headshots. I don't know. You look for headshots.
Do you?
In Germany, weirdly, there is this chain of photography stores that they just take photos like headshots and passport photos and quick family portraits. And they're like in every mall and on every second street. Mm-hmm. They're called Studio Line. And it's a much better quality of, so you could go there and do that really easily. In Germany, that's where I would tell you to go to get a new headshot. Just do some hair and makeup and go in there, and they'll give you sort of, you know, they'll do the over the where you look over the shoulder, like not the cutesy way, the business way. Not, they're not taking it from above and you're like giving it, looking up over your shoulder. Like they're giving you the you know, the five, you know, business kind of shot, profile things. Anyway, Kirstie, I just wanted to say I did read your updated LinkedIn and I was very impressed. And also, I was also pretty interested to see the thing you've got around your photo, the little photo thing that's hashtag open to work.
Yes.
Because that was new for me. And I was thinking, you know, LinkedIn is probably a pretty solid place right now in terms of its viability as a actual application in the world. And I was thinking, one, do you put open to work if you're working somewhere and you want to move jobs? And how does that look? Or do you put open to work if you're a freelancer like yourself? You know, you can do that without offending anyone you're currently working for.
Yeah.
Or, you know, when do you put that on, or you've been made redundant or you're out of work looking for a new job? Or when does that go on there? And is LinkedIn finally going to come into its own? You know, for years and years, people have been saying LinkedIn is the best proposition because all the data's there and people have to put their real name and their real contact details, which they don't have to do on other social media things. Because if you want a job, you have to be able to be contacted.
I think LinkedIn has a specific audience, and I think, you know, Nikki, for you and I, it definitely wasn't ever going to be our thing, but for my husband, he loves it, absolutely loves it, lives on it, thrives on it, loves the connections, loves what he learns, loves reading people's articles that they share, and the work side of it, and he uses it, I think, to its full capacity. Whereas I was never that way. I can feel myself getting pulled back into LinkedIn now because there's a few little courses that I want to do. And I can see that LinkedIn is now, like, it sends me things every day saying, maybe you might like this job, maybe you might like this job. And it's like, oh, gee, that's a good job. I think you're right. When I think about it, I think because maybe people are going to go for the straight up meat and potatoes without, you know, all the flashy sides.
Yeah, could be. But anyway, good job on your LinkedIn and good job finding a headshot photographer.
Yeah, it's really good. Oh, I just realized I didn't ask you. Have you got any plans for what you're going to do next week? Did you end up, what did you do? You cleared the attic.
I cleared the attic and I'm working on my little Expat Kids Learning Differently. Yes, I bought the domain name, expatkidslearningdifferently.com.
Well done.
So that's moving in the right direction. And I'm editing some old interviews that I did with people from there. So I'm working towards having some usable things there. So, yeah, I'm doing that. And then I've got a plan. I've got it all laid out. So hopefully I'll move forward on that this week as well. But, yes, I did. But tell me about the split season two, because I loved the split season one. Loved it.
Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? And after season one, you'd think, oh, how's season two? I thought it was maybe even better. So for those who can't remember, the split is the story of the family of lawyers. It's all women. It's a very female cast, isn't it? The female-led cast, I should say. The lead character, Hannah Stern, who's played by Nicola Walker, it's probably season two. The real focus is on her and her husband, Nathan, who is played by Stephen Mangan, who was in, what was that series with Joey from Friends and
episodes. He's so good.
He's so good. He's such so a great
actor. He was also in The Green Wing. I mean, he's a great comedic actor. He's very good. But this is like a dramatic role.
Yes. Yeah, which he's brilliant at. So it kind of opens and you realize they're together. And what I actually did was went back to season one and had a look at the previews again and went, oh, that's right, that's right, that's right, and then started again. Because at the end of season one, you're not sure whether she is going to run up with someone else. And, of course, she's a divorce lawyer, which makes it even more interesting. They all work in the world of family law. And so you see that they're together, but then you can kind of see that there's some other stuff going on. So I won't ruin it by talking all about the characters, but I will say that it is absolutely brilliant in that whole, you know, British drama way. The characters are brilliant. There was only one person that I thought, oh, I'm not sure if I'm really buying her, but then maybe she was just playing her character so well because she played – you know, they always have what's going on in their family, but they'll have a case as well that they're working on, and that one case is kind of takes you through the seasons. I think there's through the episodes. I think there's six episodes to a season. They have the sort of the reality TV couple that have their own situation going on, and she plays the, you know, superstar British television person. So, but it was really good, and of course at the end of it sets it up perfectly for season three.
Of course.
Yes. What else is on my favorite things? I also had I think you and I have both got the same thing on, not our favorite things maybe, but
no,
our
but just something that to talk about. Yeah.
The Social Dilemma. I shared a chat that you and I had about The Social Dilemma and how I sort of found that it presented to me all the problems of social media without a lot of solutions, but it was also things I don't think I learnt anything that I didn't already know. And I think that may be because I had listened to Rabbit Hole by the New York Times podcast, and I really felt that everything I'd learnt on Rabbit Hole was in The Social Dilemma. What about you?
No, I do. I think you used the word espresso depresso, and people were quite happy with that term. I think you're going to have some new users of that globally. Where'd you hear that? Oh, Kirsty Rice uses that term. but yeah, look, you and I, we've listened to Rabbit Hole, plus we use social media, so we understand what it does and what it's doing. And I think the people that said, you know, and there's so many people saying, you've got to watch it, you've got to watch it, you've got to watch it. And I thought, okay, I do have to watch it. I probably enjoyed it. Like, I thought it was quite interesting. But I didn't learn anything I didn't already know. There were some things, you know, so some particular comments that I thought, oh, yeah, well, that's what, you know, like algorithms are opinions embedded in code. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's true. Like there's someone makes the algorithm based on their own opinion, more or less, so to speak.
Yes, and that they didn't really know how those algorithms were going to
work. No, and they just made them. So, and fake news on Twitter spreads six times faster than actual news, which I think
gossip always spreads
absolutely
faster.
Horrifying. And the you know, that they've opened a box that they don't know how to close, which, I mean, don't we all know that? But I think if you don't spend time thinking about what social media is, you know, and a lot of people have watched and said, oh, I've taken, you know, the phones away from my children, I've taken the apps away, I've done this, I've done that. I'm thinking, well, is that the answer? Because as you said, there wasn't a lot of answers, but the answer is to be aware and understand, you know, and you know, how do you wake up from the matrix when you don't know you're in the matrix, was one of the quotes. And I think that is true. Like if you say to someone, okay, you can have your phone or you can have this social media, that's fine, but be aware. Or if you say, no, you can't have that because you're not developed enough and you don't understand it. I mean, to me, that's that's valid in a lot of situations. I'm not saying it's not valid, but it's also a symptom of the person who's responsible. As an adult, as a parent, now we have to negotiate this. Like, this is something else we have to understand and put in our parenting packet, or, you know, whatever, like if we're going to be a parent. But also there are adults who get led down these paths and don't get out, as rabbit hole presented. But also, like, how did it come to our notice? As a New York Times article said, the movie is streaming on Netflix, where it'll become another node in the service data's based algorithm. You know, like it came up as a suggestion for everybody, and all the people I know who've seen it and are commenting on it think in a certain way. So is it being shown to other people? You know, like I found it, like you said, we both saw it. We both learned nothing new. I kind of liked, for people that didn't really understand algorithms and how all the applications work together on your phone, I thought the little guys in the control room was a good analogy.
I didn't like the dramatization. I found it almost a little bit insulting. But then I thought, because there was a conversation that came up about it in our group, and I thought, hold it, maybe this is based at children, that they're going to show this as something for children to watch. So it's like they're speaking down to a child, because that's how I felt it was being explained to me.
But I think that's because you know about it, because I think I've seen people say, oh, wow, that was so mind opening. Like, I never understood that. And I think, how could you not understand that? It's about social media. But it's just a situation that we spend a lot of time in it, and other people don't, I guess. Or other people do without realizing what's actually happening, why they keep picking up their phone. Yeah.
Do you know, that many people told me to watch it, that when I clicked on it, when we pressed play, we were 5 to 10 minutes into it, and I thought, oh, I've clicked on the wrong thing. This can't be it, because this isn't good enough. Do you know? And I actually got out my phone to sort of look at the messages that people had sent me to say, oh, you need to watch it. And said to Henry, is this called The Social Dilemma? Are we on the right? And he was like, yep, that's what it's called. And it's interesting, because my husband's reaction to it was, I think probably 20 minutes in, he said, are we going to keep watching this? And then how long does this go for? And then I'm going to go have a shower. I can't do this anymore. And he doesn't live in the world of social media, but he just said, oh, my gosh, they're giving no answers, no solutions. They're just telling us all that's wrong with the world, and I don't need this in my life. And so, yeah, my expression of this is all a bit espresso depresso was totally, because it did sort of have that feeling of, you know, I'm waiting for this to come in with, well, you know, here's some solutions. Now, I have seen that there is this thing in Silicon Valley, I think I read about it earlier in the year, at the end of last year, called dopamine fasting. Have you heard about dopamine fasting, Nikki?
Yeah. Oh, no, but yeah. I don't think I want to do it.
And, you know, and it has come from Silicon Valley, and it's all about that you take all those things away, but you also take away food and sex and everything that, you know, gives you dopamine.
Yeah, well, that's the reason dopamine, yeah, no, chocolate.
Yeah,
sugar.
You may do that for however amount of time, and then it gives your body that reset. And of course, you know, there's been journalists that have then done it, but of course, those journalists are all, you know, 20 years old and living with their parents, and you know, telling you the what it's done for them. So, I guess I probably would have liked sort of a few more things like that at towards the end of it. Of, you know, if this is done for children or for people for shock value or whatever, then give me but this is what we can do about it.
Yeah, I thought a lot of people have said, see, all those people in Silicon Valley don't let their kids have phones. I was like, that was kind of like almost like an add-in at the end.
Yeah.
You know, those little snippets were, they just sort of threw those in at the end, which was that the message, like, get your kids off? I thought it was good in sort of presenting information, but then I thought it was not really guided in what it was trying to say. What was it trying to say?
Yeah. Okay, Nikki, did you know you can freeze avocado?
No, I'm going to say no.
I didn't either. And you can freeze it and it stays green. It doesn't go brown. It's something I've learned this week and I feel the need to share it, that you can cut up your avocados because avocados aren't always in season. I have a sister who lives right in on an avocado, I guess some people would call it a farm, we would call it a block, and always comes down with avocados, but they're not always readily available, but you can freeze them. This is something I felt I needed to share. Last thing I wanted to ask you was, did you watch the live read of Fast Times at Ridgemont High?
Of course. although I don't think I watched the whole hour. I did watch bits and bobs.
I actually sat down and consumed the whole hour because I was fascinated by it all. I loved it. So, of course, everyone's talking about Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston because they were both in it and they were cute and they said hi to each other and, you know, the world exploded because they were together on the same Zoom call and we all got to be voyeuristic and watch it. But I
can't believe we're still obsessed with Brad.
I know. But I just, the one I thought was great was Morgan Freeman and his
performance. No, he's amazing.
He's just amazing. Like, how do you just read like that off the bat and be so intoxicating? But also Julia Roberts, I loved her glee of just being part of it and watching it as well. And just, I mean, she was great. But you could tell she was almost enjoying it as much as we were enjoying watching Brad and Jen, I reckon.
I loved when Chrissy Teigen walked in to John Legend and Julia Roberts goes, she just walks around the house like that? Like that's just what she looks like on a normal day?
Yeah, it was good. It was good. Hey, there was a question in the Two Fat Expats group this week too. Someone was asking, where do you keep all your recipes? You know how you're
yes, I saw that. Yeah.
And the general consensus was a site called Paprika. And I
yeah, it was very strong consensus.
Yes. And so I thought that might be a good tip for people as well. Because I'm the same. Like I'm a big New York Times recipe follower.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're picking up stuff all the time. From all over the place. So I thought it was just a really good question and a good suggestion.
Yeah, and I also thought the good point was someone said, oh, they have Pinterest pages, but if the blog goes out, you know, if the website where it's from goes down, then you lose the recipe. And yeah. And someone else said, I don't want your blog post, I just want your recipe. I don't care about your 15 yes. posts. And it's so true. It's so true.
Yeah, I don't want to hear about when you and Jimmy drove to the country and what the flowers looked like and what the temperature was and whatever. Yeah, no, just tell me how many eggs and if I need paprika.
Yeah. Okay. My last two things. The circus. If you are following US politics and the US election, you must be watching the circus.
Really?
It is amazing. It started off during the 2016 campaign season, and it's a group of political reporters or functionaries who followed the candidates and the campaigns. And it's highly produced, highly stylized. It's not narrated, so it just cuts from scene to scene to scene. And at the moment they're doing it pandemically, and so they're all having these conversations, and they have production teams in each location. So one guy's sitting on his balcony, one guy's, you know, in a cafe, one guy's somewhere else, and they're all talking about sort of the politics of the day and what the candidates did. And it's a candidate level stuff. And you can go back and watch the previous seasons and it will just blow your mind, because it started with the 2016, as I said, the 2016 campaign, and then it goes through from there. So I think they're on season 5 at the moment. It took them a long time to get the production up and going, but I think there's 6 or 7 episodes into this season, and it is fantastic. And it's great. I think it's on Stan in Australia. It's on Hulu for me. My last favorite thing for today, which I think is also a community service announcement and very important. If you don't have AirPods, because I know not everybody has an iPhone, I don't. I could have AirPods with my phone, but I don't. I have something called wireless earpods. They're Jabra and 75T. Now, I used to have the Jabra 65T, and I had them forever.
What does the T?
I don't know what it means. It's just the name of them. But I used to have the 65s, and they were great, and I love them. And I, you know, every day I wear them. And then my case broke. So, you know, the opening and shut, because you have to be able to shut the case to charge the AirPods. So I looked online to buy a new case, because I thought, oh, that's what I'll do. I'll buy a new case. And buying a new case was nearly as expensive as buying a new pair. So I thought, stuff it. It's something I use all the time. So I'm going to treat myself and buy a new pair. And can I tell you, they are freaking amazing. They are like at least a 50% step up. They're just a better fit in your ear. They're sort of better sound. They're better battery life. They're just, I love them. And I think everyone should have them. And they're also sort of waterproof, so you can wear them in the shower. You know, like it's just, you never have to be without a podcast in your ears ever.
You wear them in the shower?
Yeah. I do sometimes. If I'm just jumping into the shower and listening to a podcast, I just quickly jump in and listen.
Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. So, that's going to be a much longer conversation that you and I have offline. I'm fascinated by that. I have the whole speaker situation, you know, where I'm Bluetoothing and doing whatever.
I do. I also have a speaker.
But I just can't imagine sharing with something in my ears.
I usually just have one, to be fair. I'm a one-ear girl.
Yeah, you are a one-ear girl. You are a one-ear girl.
And because I like to think that I'm not going to be startled by other noises. And I love them. I don't wash my hair, but I'll have a shower. Yes. If I wash my hair, I go to the speaker. Yes. Or I don't listen to anything at all, which can be very disconcerting.
Yes. And washing behind your ears, are you not nervous that they're going to pop out and down the sink?
I'm not sure I wash behind my ears every
time. Okay. Now, Nikki, I'm reading, because, of course, I had to go on Google immediately, the Elite 65T versus the Elite 75T. And they're saying that, yes, what you're experiencing now is complete earbud stability, whereas before you didn't have it with the 65T. The 75T is giving you earbuds stability, especially if you had larger ears, according to this man.
Well, I probably do have larger ears. I don't know, but I couldn't believe there was such a difference. Like I was just like, oh, well, it's just the next version, whatever.
Yeah.
But I love
them.
They
look good. They look good. And for people that can't see them like I can, because with the iPods, obviously you have with the AirPods, you have that little dangly bit hanging down and everyone can see.
Oh, but that's cool, apparently.
Is it?
I don't know. I think it's a bit of a status symbol to have the dangly bit.
Maybe much younger than us. But with your Jabra 75Ts, they fit right inside your ear. Nikki, I think you've sold me. I think you have sold me, because I need to do that too, because what I'm sick of now that we have the Labradoodle puppy is because I have the cord.
The cords are, the cords are old.
The cord. And the wireless buds that I do have, of course, are sitting by my bed in Doha because they didn't get packed in the rush. Just another thing that got left behind. I'm thinking I might have to go and have a look at this.
Well, they're Bluetooth connect. They connect to your computer, to your, to your speaker, to your whatever.
Yeah.
Also to your phone, to your iPad, anything you need them to connect to, there they go. To the TV, whatever you want.
Now only the right earbud works independently, I'm told.
Correct. And I understand that with AirPods that you can either wear either one, but I'm used to having just one in my right ear, so I'm fine with that.
Now, what do they mean by no wireless charging case?
No wireless charging case. I don't know. It's just like a little case. It just looks like an AirPod case. It's just a different color depending on what color earbuds you get.
Do you have to plug it into the wall? You can't just pop it on top of something. Maybe that's what that means.
Yeah, like you have to. It charges with a USC connector. But the good thing is now you have an app on your phone and it tells me how much charge is in the charging case as well as how much charge is in the AirPod that's in my ear.
That's clever.
So before I didn't know how, when I had to charge the charging case again, but now I do.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And you're getting a lot of, you're getting like something like 7 hours worth of battery life, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm getting a whole day. I don't charge for the whole day.
Amazing. I just have to point out to people that we are not getting paid anything for this, that this is a legit conversation. Not sponsored.
Because this is how much music, how many podcasts I listen to. Yes. Like I always have one in the supermarket, in going to work, in the office. A lot of people wear headphones. So I'm like, well, no one else is, but they all wear them on their heads. So when people talk to me and I don't answer, they just think I'm an old lady who can't hear them, which is also true. But anyway.
So the battery life on the case is 20 hours and then the battery life on the buds is 7.5. That's very good. So, yes, the Jabra Elite 75T, $180, it says here.
I tell you, look, I mean, I have got my money, value for money out of them in the last few weeks. Easy.
Okay. All right.
All right, Kirsty.
Now, Nikki, I didn't catch, have you got any plans for you, what you're going to focus on this week, what little habit or thought or of our four fat things of just to close off on the LinkedIn profile, I will go and find a professional pick. Thanks for your advice about what happens in Germany. But I will see if I can find someone.
I'm not sure that it's an equivalent in Australia, but good luck with that.
I think that'll be my thing. Have you got a plan for this week, what you're going to do?
Yes, I am going to keep going with the project that I'm working on. So now I've got a bit of momentum. I'm just going to keep going with that. So I'm going to finish up the interview editing and bits and bobs like that. So just wrap that up. Beautiful. To make sure it's done.
Okay. All right. Nikki Moffat, I will talk to you next week.
Speak to you then. Bye.